You've heard us say here at Mosaic Church, talking a little bit about some of the practicalities that we live in as we unpack the core values. And the first core value, obviously, just the simplicity of loving God, right? And under that core value, we've had a particular one that we've spent some time on, this idea of living simply, working diligently and giving generously. And in particular, in the area of living simply, it's really neat to begin to see how living simply and the cost of living simply to us starts expanding into freedoms for other people. And, you know, just standing here on Memorial Day and realizing how many people have set aside the lives that they lived for our freedoms, and now we get to set aside some of the life that we live for the sake of the freedoms of others. And, you know, this week was one of those moments in time where I got to observe some of the practical things we talk about here unfold in my very own home. As you guys probably remember, when we were talking about living simply the very first time, I was working on it with my children, and my oldest daughter, Hadley, she's 9 years old, she kind of helped coin for me the phrase that talked about what it means to live simply, and her version of it has kind of become my version of it, which was simply to say that you, with whatever you have, that you always give before you save, save before you spend, and spend only what you have. So that's easiest in its translation financially, but it translates into every other area of life. You look at your time, and you ask yourself, you know, I'm going to give away my time before I start my schedule. Then I'm going to save some time for the things that I need and that others need, and then I'm going to spend whatever's left. Instead, what we do is we allow our schedules to drive us so that there's nothing left to give and nothing left to save, right? We do it with our resources. We do it with our talents and our gifts. We'll spend ourselves, and then if there's leftovers, we'll try to do something with that. And this week, I'm sitting in the house, and Brooke had purchased, I think as a gift for somebody else, this little black dress with these white little polka dots on it, and Hadley, my 9-year-old, just loved the dress, right? So yesterday morning, she says to her mom, "Mom, how much was the dress?" And it's always, you know, that's a loaded question. So Brooke goes, "Well, I think it was $11. So Hadley goes, "Do you think I could buy that dress?" You know, so Brooke said, "Well, yeah, let's go and see how much money you have saved up, and then we can take a look." Now, my children, between birthday money and allowances and all those other things, over the last few months and years, they've just been saving their money because we really haven't gotten to that point in life where they're off spending money a lot. So really, yesterday was the first time that in my household, my oldest daughter is starting to step into the world of, "Can I?" So we say, "Sure, go upstairs, collect all the money you have, bring it down, we'll see what you got." So she does, right? She comes down on the table. I'm expecting like $7 or $8. $80! $80! I'm like, "Wow, could I borrow some?" And so we split it on the table, right? And so I said to Hadley, I said, "Okay, honey, before we start talking about the dress, what do we do first?" And boom, right there, she's right there. She goes, "Well, we give before we save before we spend, and then we spend what we have." So I said, "Okay, well, let's do that." And so Brooke and I, we kind of talked earlier in the morning, and we said, let's start our kids off way beyond where they should be. That way, as they grow into adults and go the wrong direction, they might actually land where they need to be, right? So biblically speaking, the principle is you take 10% of what you have and you give it away, then you take 10% of what you have and you save it, and then what's left, 80% you spend, right? So I look at Hadley and I said, "Now, honey, here's what we do. We take 20% and we give it away first. Then we take 20% and we save it, and then we can spend what's left." So she begins, you know? And she's a little math crazy person, unlike me. I actually got it wrong in the last service, believe it or not. My wife had to correct me. It's 46, not 48. I'm like, "Oh, sorry." So she starts doing the math. 10% multiplies by 2, 20%, $16, right? So she takes the $16 and shifts it out. Then she does it again for the savings and shifts it out. And we look at that, and she's all excited about coming to church today and giving her money to what God is up to and all, and then putting money back in the piggy bank to save. And you know what's sitting left over on the table, right? So 32 and 32, I mean 16 and 16 is what? 32. See, I told you I got it wrong. 16, 16, 32. And what's 80 minus 32? It's not hard. 40. I said 48. My wife said you were wrong. Am I wrong? It is 48. See? I wish you were here. Are you recording this? I'm so going home right now and telling her, "I'm never right." So this will be a huge opportunity. Okay, so She's left over with $48. You know what my daughter does? She looks at the $48 and she goes, "Wow, that's a lot of money." And I go, "Yeah, it sure is." And she goes, "And I only have to spend 11 of it on a dress, and then I'll have a boatload of money left over." And I said, "Yes." And she, and you could just see it in her eyes at 9 years old. The 16 she gave away, 20%, and the 16 she saved didn't even faze her. What fazed her was that God left her with $48 that she could spend. And I stood at that table and I thought to myself, wow, how refreshing is that to see a 9-year-old deal with what God has given her from that perspective. Instead of going, "Oh my goodness, I have to give $16 away." She goes, "I'm left with 48. And I stood there looking at this, and today is not about money at all. It really isn't. You'll be surprised. But I looked at this, and I realized what was happening at the table was that one of the basic principles of God, a principle of God that generally is one of those that perhaps when we read it, we wish God didn't put it in the Bible. You know, there's those that you go, "Oh, I'm so glad God asked me to do this, but this one right here is not so nice." And when God calls us out of what he's given us to give back, that's always tough. And here she is at the table, and we have started her at a high level, and she is so thoroughly enjoying living out a principle that God has given her. Extraordinary, right? And then it just dawned on me how often we take the principles of God and we compromise on the little things. And that kind of led me into exactly where Israel is at this point. Because, you know, we're walking through the history of the Old Testament and through Israel's history, and they're walking into what is probably, without a shadow of a doubt, the darkest time that they will ever walk into. Because we've closed out 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and at the very end of 2 Kings, we're walking into what is going to become the Babylonian captivity. Now, the Babylonian captivity, we find a lot of our information on that in some of the books we're about to walk into, and the starting point for that is the book of Daniel. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be spending a fair amount of time in the book of Daniel. Today, you're welcome to grab your Bibles, but I'm going to kind of do an overview touch here and there, and then we'll jump deeply in next week. But in Daniel chapter 1, in verse 1, this is what it says, okay? It says, "In the third year of the reign of Joachim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." It goes on to tell us in chapter 1 of Daniel that what Nebuchadnezzar did was that he came in, he took King Joachim off the throne, he put another Jewish person on the throne that was still in the line of Jehoiakim, King Zedekiah, put him on the throne, and with Jehoiakim, he selected the cream of the crop in Jerusalem and brought them over to Babylon. He asked for all of the up-and-coming hopefuls in the society, the people that were going to be the greats, at least from a worldly perspective, and said, "I want those people to come to Babylon." One of the people that was in that group was a man named Daniel. Actually, at that time, he was probably a teenager, and he is heading out from Jerusalem to Babylon. Now, I want to give you a perspective here because it's easy to miss this in the story. Babylon is 900 miles away from Jerusalem, okay? Now, 900 miles for you and I doesn't seem like that much. It's not even worth the frequent flyer miles, right? But 900 miles when you are walking by foot is no small task. Not only that, but in that day and time, 900 miles may have been 20,000 miles. It was all the way away from Jerusalem, all the way out of the promised land, all the way to a place you don't know. And these guys show up there, and this was the first group of people that were exiled, the same group of people that Jeremiah is writing to in Jeremiah 29, when he's writing to the exiles saying, "Settle down, buy some houses, marry some people, because you're going to be there a while." Remember, the false prophets were sharing and saying, "Hey, don't worry, you're going to come right back to Jerusalem in no time." And Jeremiah says, "Don't listen to these guys. They don't know what they're talking about. They're just saying what the king wants to hear. You are going to be there while, as a matter of fact, things are going to get a lot worse before they get any better." So he writes to these guys. Now, I want to give you a little bit of perspective on what's going on underneath the surface of what seems obvious. Obviously, if you live in the Orlando area, somebody travels from 900 miles away, comes into Orlando, besieges the city, wipes us out, gets their own rulers in play, then takes us, travels us all over 900 miles away and tells us you have to settle in this new place, that would be bad enough, would it not? I mean, you'd be going, man, I'm pulled from my home. Everything I know, it's gone. But there's so much more going on here than just that. Remember that what we're tied to here in Jerusalem is something that God has been up to for years and years and years. It started when he called the people out of Egypt and crossed the Red Sea. He made a promise to the people then, didn't he? He said to the people, I'm going to take you into a promised land, and in that promised land, I'm going to settle you there, and that is going to be your land, and I'm going to protect you in that land. I'm going to keep you safe in that land, and we are going to be a family. I'm going to be your God, and you are going to be my people. And it's going to be wonderful. And after a little bit of detouring through the desert for a few years and the death of a whole generation and all that stuff, as you well know, God leads them with Joshua into the promised land, right? And when they're in the promised land, they settle there. And over the next few hundred years, lots of things go wrong in the promised land. But the basic system is that no matter who comes in and conquers and whatever, they're still there. The northern kingdom gets destroyed. The southern kingdom stays and holds its own. And there's another part that's critical to this in the southern kingdom. What is the dynasty that is running in the southern kingdom? It is the Davidic dynasty, right? That is from King David. And there's a very good reason why that is, because in the northern kingdom, remember, the dynasties changed all the time, but in the southern kingdom was always the Davidic dynasty. This comes to the second great promise that God made. Remember that God said when David was on the throne, because first Saul was picked as king, and that was the people's pick, and it went bad. Then God picked David as king, and he said to the people, the Davidic throne will last for how long? Forever. That's right. Forever. There will be no breaking of the Davidic throne throughout eternity. It is going to last forever. If you are listening from the perspective of the Israelites, you're going, this is a sweet deal, man. I mean, God is basically guaranteeing us that we are going to be in the land and that the Davidic throne will reign forever. There is no nation on the planet that will be able to thwart that part of God. Now, what has Israel been up to since these two great promises have been made? You know what they've been doing? They have been basically, as a nation, not maybe every individual, but as a nation, they've been ignoring all the small principles and commands of God. Every time God made a small promise, like for instance, hold your ground, don't set up alliances, I will protect you. Oh no, that one's, we ignore that one, we don't do that. Or stay here, or go there, or do this, or don't do that. Oh, ignore those. The small principles, they throw by the wayside and they compromise constantly, which is why, in so many ways, they are not experiencing the freedom that God intended for them here in this mess that Babylon's walking into to take over, right? But imagine to yourself what an incredible devastation it must have been for the people that were exiled first, Daniel and those guys. They go to Babylon, and what is the one hope that they have? That we can go back, right? We're going to go back. It's okay. This is horrible, but we're going to go back. Can you imagine what it must have been like in 586 BC when they see Nebuchadnezzar head out with his armies? They're not sure what's going on, and he comes back, and all of the people from Jerusalem have been brought back to Babylon, at least most of them. And the whispers start traveling around Babylon. Can you imagine the first time guys like Daniel said, "What happened?" And they go, "It's all gone. It's all gone. Everything. They came in and they wiped Jerusalem out. They destroyed the temple. They broke it apart. There is no more temple. There is no more Jerusalem." Well, who stayed? Hardly anybody stayed. There's no one left. Everyone's here now. We're all Babylonians now. We all walked the 900 miles. Can you imagine what it must have been like when they finally said it? Well, is there still a king on the throne? No, there's no king. The king has been taken. There is no king. There is no Davidic line. There is no nothing anymore. Can you imagine what it must have been like for them to realize that the two greatest promises on which at least they had their hope was that they would stay in the promised land and that the Davidic line would never die, and in one foul swoop, they are no longer in the promised land and the Davidic line is dead. And you walk out of that into Babylon. Now, one little thing kind of is a glimmer, if you will, of hope. Back in Israel, Nebuchadnezzar leaves a small little ragtag band of people there, right? That little ragtag band of people is governed by a Jewish man that Nebuchadnezzar put in place because he was loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah, the prophet, was given the option to either travel back to Babylon or to stay in Mitzvah, which was right above Jerusalem, a little village, if you will, a little town where they could kind of establish some semblance of an Israelite grouping because Jerusalem's destroyed. Jeremiah stays up there, and this governor starts to rule. But within just a very short period of time, a man named Ishmael comes in, and he kills the governor because he was sort of under the guidance and the leadership of the king of Ammon. The king of Ammon, Balas, was kind of up north, and they wanted to make sure, we're not exactly sure based on history, but they wanted to make sure that Babylon didn't get a hold on too many things. So they pick Ishmael and tell him, we will back you up if you take this little grouping and kind of reestablish something of a semblance of Israel on the ground. Okay, so while all this is going on, we find all of this out in Jeremiah chapter 41, 42, 43, 44, and 45. You can read those chapters. It's all there, right? So they're on the ground. Ishmael kills the governor and a few of the armies, the guards from Nebuchadnezzar. And when they die, 2 days later, the military leader that is also there, also a Jewish man, established by Nebuchadnezzar, finds out about this. So he chases Ishmael down, and Ishmael takes hostages, including the daughter of King Zedekiah, who had been removed and taken up north. And they take off, and guess what they do? They chase this guy down, Ishmael. They rescue the hostages, but Ishmael escapes with a few of his men and goes up north to Balas, to the king of Ammon, and he settles there, and the Jewish people start scattering. In the meantime, the military leader comes back to Jeremiah, and this is what he says. He says to him, look, when Babylon finds out about this mess, they're going to be ticked, and they're going to come in here, and we're going to face the repercussions of this. Should we flee to Egypt and hide there? Would you ask God? So Jeremiah goes, God, what should we do? And God goes, stay put. Don't worry about it. Babylon will not retaliate. You'll be fine. So guess what they do? They come back together. Jeremiah says, God said, stay put. They go, good, let's go to Egypt. You're just like, what are you doing? I mean, it's like the last glimmer of hope on the ground. And what are they doing? Ask God. What? Oh, I didn't think you'd say that. I was sure you were going to say go to Egypt. Well, since you didn't, we're going to go to Egypt anyways. I mean, how often have you not done that? You go to God because you're so sure you know what he's going to say. God, that person was really mean. What should I do? Love your enemies. No, let me ask that again. They were really mean. What should I do? You know, we do that all the time, and here they are. God, what should I do? Stay. No! And they run to Egypt. And you know what else they do? They take Jeremiah with them as a hostage. Jeremiah gets to Egypt, and he lays some rocks on the ground, and he prophesies, and he says, because you guys did not listen to God and stay put when he told you to, Nebuchadnezzar is going to make his way all the way to Egypt. He's going to wipe Egypt off the map, and none of you will get to return to the promised land because you will die here. And there we are. That's the last glimmer of hope for Israel. Pretty sad state of affairs, isn't it? In the meantime, the rest of the nation of Israel are walking into what? They are walking into Babylon. You want to know about Babylon? Let me tell you about Babylon. When you walk up to the city of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar was an incredible strategist, and he built a city like no other on the planet. There were walls around Babylon that stretched 55 square miles. Can you imagine that? Building walls 55 square miles. The walls went all around the 55 square mile radius. The walls, the inner wall, was 23 feet thick. Then in between the inner wall and the outer wall, there was 38 feet of space so the two chariots could ride side by side between the two walls. The outer wall was 22 feet thick. On the inner wall, inside the inner wall, there was a third wall built inside the inner wall that was 12 feet thick. So that if an enemy breached the outer wall somehow, which was practically impossible, they would be stuck in between two massive walls with 38 feet of space and chariots with horses chasing them down. And if by some miracle they broke through the second wall, they'd run into a third wall inside the second wall that was 12 feet thick. I mean, you could not get through. And then on top of that, they established every 160 feet, they established a watchtower that rose 90 feet up into the air. And at 90 feet, they had every 160 feet one of these that put over 360 watchtowers around the entire city wall. I mean, the sight of Babylon as you looked from the outside must have been extraordinary. The main gate as you entered in, that was the most famous gate in Babylon, and it was a gate called the Gate of Ishtar. And as you walked up to the Gate of Ishtar, the Gate of Ishtar was so massive and so huge. It was 15 feet wide. It was 35 feet high. It was made of beautiful cedar wood, the deep red wood, with bronze cut across it constantly. And when those gates opened, it opened up to a road that stretched before you, and that road was 73 feet wide. It had 120 lions that lined the road as you went in. Can you imagine if you were coming from Israel, you just seen this destruction of the temple and your walls, and you walk into Babylon, the great city, and from a distance you already see it. At the end of that road that stretched into Babylon, there was a tiered tower that would have had the resemblance of the Tower of Babel, and it was actually called something very similar. It was called the House of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. And at the very top of this tower, Marduk, the god of Babylon, had his temple. And this tower stretched 300 feet up into the sky so that from any distance around, you would see the tower and you'd see the temple of Marduk on the top of it. They had another god thing that they did, a temple, if you will. It was called the Temple Mount. It stretched 470 feet up into the sky along that same road. And it was another sideline temple for a sideline god. Not only that, but one of his wives, Nebuchadnezzar's wives, was from another region where it was very mountainous and hilly, and there were lots of rainforest type of things. And so you know what he did? He picked one of the most beautiful parts of Babylon, and it was called Kashar, and he built this palace there. And inside that palace, he built what we know as the Hanging Gardens. The Hanging Gardens is still considered one of the seven wonders of the world because we can't figure out how on earth he pulled it off. But he built some of the most beautiful and unbelievable things. In the middle of Babylon, the river Euphrates ran straight through the middle of the city, and there was Old Babylon and New Babylon. And across the river, they built a bridge. And on either side of the river, the bridge had two pillars 600 feet up on either side. So that's four total pillars. And the bridge that crossed the river was 30 feet wide. I mean, from a technological standpoint, walking into that city, you must have walked into something so extraordinary, something so beyond your wildest imagination, it must have blown your mind. It was stunning, beautiful, extraordinary. You could feel the power. And that's not all. Babylon was the economic capital of the planet at the time. It was the financial capital of the planet. It had the greatest armies. It was conquering everybody. The Babylonian Empire was stretching as far as land existed. They were going to continue to do that. And Babylon, when you walked in as a captive of Babylon, guess what they did? You didn't walk in and walk into some dungeon under the ground. They walked you in and they said, here's the deal. As long as you stay faithful to Babylon and stay faithful to the king of Babylon, you are welcome into our city. You can live among us. You can have businesses. You can own a house on the main boulevard. You can live the life. It's an incredible life to live. And let me tell you, Babylon seduced you in a way that no culture probably since has. And in that beautiful seduction, walk into the gates, the nation of Israel, who have not only experienced the devastation of their land, have not only walked out of the promises that they thought were rock solid, have not only seen the divinic line come crashing and burning to the ground, but they have been living a life of compromise for as far back as the eye can see. What do you think the chances are that the nation of Israel were going to live faithfully in freedom in the middle of Babylon? I'll tell you what the chances are. Zero. You just give them a little bit of time, and before you know it, they will forget where they are and they will enjoy that life. And we know that to be true because just 70 years later, when given the opportunity to go back and rebuild the walls, guess what? Most of the people didn't want to leave. They wanted to stay. They were like, we don't want to go back to the promised land, to the mess that's left there. We want to stay right here. See, they had no way to hold on to the great promises of God because they had been compromising on the small promises of God their whole life. And the reality is, you and I know that just a few hundred years later, born onto this planet of a virgin is a man named Jesus. And that man is born of a woman whose line happens to go bad. Bloodline goes back to guess who? David. And then his dad, who had no blood tie to him because he was born of a virgin, but in that culture, that's how they determined who you were. Guess what his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was? David. So it didn't matter which one of the two parents you picked, they both went back to the divinic line. And guess who Jesus turned out to be? Turned out to be the king of the universe, the God creator, the one that sustains everything. And he is the one who will reign on the throne for how long? Forever. See, God's promises never shook for one split second. As a matter of fact, the greatest time in history to see God hold his promises together were during the time of Babylon. Because Babylon, if there's any nation that should have derailed God's promises, it was Babylon. And Babylon held his promise, God held his promises faithful through Babylon and Persia and whoever else came along. So in fact, in the time that you most feel like God's promises are distant, it's often that time that God's promises are most settled. But there's no way you could know that if you've been living a life compromising all the little promises, all the little commands, all the little things God calls you to, right? So here the people stand, and guess what we find? As we walk into the gates of Babylon next week and the week after that, and we're going to spend some time in Babylon. I don't have people build stuff like this if we're going to do it for 1 week. So we're going to be here for a while. And as we spend time in Babylon, hear me now. Some of the greatest miracles you will experience in the Old and New Testament combined will happen right here in Babylon. Some of the most impossible stories you will ever hear happen right here in Babylon. Some of the most extraordinary wonders of God happen right here in Babylon. I mean, the Red Sea and the moving out of Egypt, that was one time in history. Then Babylon is the next time in history. And then you have the coming of Christ and the resurrection. And those three times in history are probably the three most significant, miraculous times you will ever see in biblical history. And can you believe that God's greatest miracles were saved for this time in Babylon? And you know who he worked them through? The few people that demonstrated smack dab in the middle of the seduction of Babylon that they had lived a life uncompromising up till then, and they weren't planning on changing that anytime soon. They were the men and women that knew, despite the fact that it seemed like God's promises were dead, and despite the fact that it seemed like Babylon was the way to live, they stood their ground, and in the face of massive consequences, death and fire and lions and all sorts of horrible things, they put their feet down and said things like this: "I don't eat pork." You're like, you're willing to die because you're not going to eat something the king tells you to eat? Yes. Why? Well, because God said not to. You know what I'm saying? Like, you look at the things that they took the mountain on, that they charged the hill for, and you're like, dude, if you're going to fight a battle, don't fight that one. And then God whispers and says, when I give you a command, you fight that battle. Because if you learn to compromise on the little things, you will very quickly find yourself wondering if God's promises are really true. And once you're there, you will quickly find yourself going, I don't want to go back to the promised land. I like it here in Babylon. I think about Hadley, you know, sitting there at my table yesterday, counting her money out. Money. I mean, you say the word and people get nervous in church. Money. There it is. There it sits on the table. And it's hers. She's earned it. She's saved it. She's worked hard. And watching her just break that down, and without question, without thought, in fact, with great joy, separating it out and saying, this is God's, was just so fun to watch. And watching my little six-year-old boy run upstairs without word and come down with his piggy bank, start shaking it apart, and I go, what are you doing? What do you want to buy? And he goes, I don't want to buy anything. I want to take my money to God tomorrow too. Not even kidding. And Hope's next up the stairs, all put in the little Ziploc bags. They all came in, dumped it in the tithe box today, and they were so excited. They get to do this. And I go, Hadley, if you get to be 15 and you live this way, and then 20 and you live this way, and 25 and you live this way, you are miles ahead of where most people live that say they follow Christ. Because we always compromise on the little things, don't we? We always say, well, maybe next month, maybe next year, maybe next century, because right now it's just too hard to do that, even though God's asking. And you pick it. It's always different. Sometimes it's our resources. Sometimes it's our time. Sometimes it's some command God calls. Sometimes it's sharing our faith with someone. Sometimes it's just not doing something we shouldn't be doing. Doesn't matter. They're all there. And we always whisper to God, you know, I'm going to get halfway there. Like halfway somehow is some great accomplishment. And God just whispers to us and says, man, do it my way, man, seriously. Because the things that could happen. You know, I'll never know what might have happened in history if the nation of Israel had just done it God's way, right? Babylon certainly wouldn't have been able to come in, nor would Persia, nor would all those places. We talked about that. But we'll never know because they didn't. And we'll never know what might have happened in Israel if Jeremiah, when he said stay, they'd actually stayed. I don't know what God was planning to do with that and what incredible things might have happened, but they never did because they all went to Egypt and did what they thought was best. We'll never know what happened in those times, but I'll tell you what we do know. We do know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood in a fiery furnace and survived. We do know that Daniel was dumped into a lion's den. We do know that the greatest leader of the time, Nebuchadnezzar, had an episode that God did so much work in him, it's going to blow your mind. These are all the stories we're about to walk into and more. We know those stories, and we read about them all the time. You know why? Because those are the stories of people that instead of saying no to God, they said yes to God. And so they trusted God's principles and ended up experiencing God's promises. And Hadley is trusting God's principle. And I'm telling you, she will live a life if she keeps doing it in the area of her finances that she will experience God's promises. Not because it's some magic pill that if you give 10, he gives you 100-fold back. It's because if you do it his way, it always leads to great freedom. When you walk out of these doors, out there, there is something that is your profit, your gain, your thing. Mine too, right? In Philippians chapter 3, in verse 7, it says, for whatever was my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of knowing Christ Jesus. I mentioned that last week. And I was thinking all week about that. What is profit? It's so easy, right? Have you ever said this statement? Have you ever made this statement? I know I've lost everything, but at least we have our health. Have you ever made that statement? That's an obvious statement to make, you know. It's that little way of saying as a human being, as long as X, Y, or Z is in place, everything's going to be okay. But if X, Y, and Z gets out of whack, well, then we're dead in the water. Whatever that X, Y, and Z is most likely where your profit lies. In other words, it's the thing you place your significance, your security, your hope, your trust in. Some of you here sitting here, it's the security of having enough so that you have food on the table. And if that's ever lost, it's over. Some of you here, it's other things. It's who you are. It's your position. It's something on this planet where the culture of Babylon has whispered to you and I and said, this is what matters most. And Paul writes and says, whatever mattered most to me, whatever was my profit, I consider that a complete loss at this point for the sake of knowing you, Jesus, to make you my profit, my gain. When you leave here today, I don't know where you're at. I know where I'm at, and I've been challenged up the wazoo by my daughter. And I started yesterday going, God, what is it that I'm holding on to that I've been unwilling to be uncompromising in based on your principles because I have some kind of weird, whacked out excuse? Well, I'm kind of done with that. Help me see what those things are and help me to fight my way to being uncompromising in what you call me to do. If God says, do it this way, and I go, impossible, I start fighting for that. Because hear me. If you live this out God's way, if you obey what he says, this world will never be the same because we will be the Daniels and the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednegos. We will be the King Davids. We will be the Moseses and the Abrahams. We will be the stories that they will write about for the rest of history into eternity. When last did you read about the guys that went off to Egypt and got killed there? Because they didn't listen to God, probably a long time ago, maybe never. We don't want to be that story. Live God's way. Go home and read Philippians 3, 7 through 10. Whatever was my profit, God, please help me see it and get rid of it so that I can profit or consider you profit God is our world. Live in that world, and you will see where this ride takes you. Just like Hadley, starting small, growing big. Let's all do it together. Let's pray.